Hi, everybody, and welcome to Neuroscientist Talk Shop, UTSA's Neuroscience Research Podcast. Today is April 17th, 2025, and we're talking with Nicholas Priebe. Nicholas is professor in the Department of Neuroscience at the University of Texas at Austin, and his lab studies the inner workings of cerebral cortex circuits. And to do this, he focuses on visual cortex areas and how they process the visual world. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And also with us is Todd Troyer, who was there for Nicholas's previous visit with us, which was back in February 2010, when he was still an assistant professor. And by the way, that podcast predates our video series, but if you want to listen to the audio on Apple or Spotify or something, it is episode 48. And Todd was there for that one and for many other podcasts.
So yes, indeed.
Watch the podcast you're familiar with, Todd. Thanks for joining us.
Sure. Glad to be here.
And I'm your host, Charlie Wilson. So, Nicholas, I know you're interested in the degree to which visual cortical neuron responses are repeatable. You and everybody else who studies visual cortex, I think. And meaning that if we see the same stimulus, visual stimulus over and over, our neurons should respond in pretty much the same way each time, and deviations from that ought to be explainable somehow. And I listened to your previous podcast, and one of the things that came up in it, really just in passing, wasn't the main issue, but was the presence of temporally patterned activity that was like routinely there in the recordings, but wasn't in any obvious way related to visual stimulus. And we discussed what to call it, and I think you suggested we call it rumble, because that's what it seemed like in some way. And a lot's been learned since that conversation. Maybe you could bring us up to date about that, and maybe about say something about the meaning of repeatability and what we know about that kind of thing in cortex right now.
Sure. So I guess it's been maybe 14 years. I remain interested, I guess, in the sort of ongoing activity that happens in our brain, in cortex in particular, and really how that can influence how we transmit information, how our neurons transmit information. I feel like this is a question that's actually very old. It's a question that was really arose maybe in the 90s about why neurons are so variable in terms of their responses to the very same stimulus. And when people often say, why are neurons so variable, they're usually talking about the pattern of action potentials that are observed to the same visual stimulus or auditory stimulus. I've kind of taken an approach studying this that takes a different perspective, because I do whole cell recording in vivo, and that really gives me some fine scale insight into what this sort of ongoing activity actually looks like, I think what's sort of responsible for it, instead of just seeing these excitatory events, which are the action potentials. Yes, I've been interested in this repeatability issue, primarily because it actually affects how we behave. We know that the changes in firing rate of even a single neuron in RAMT, a little bit less in V1, but even a single neuron's pattern of action potentials can alter the perception that an animal has of motion or orientation. And seeing that relationship is really amazing. It's amazing to me that one cell responses could be so influential. And in fact, I think it's actually wrong to think that one cell's responses are influential. That one cell simply reflects the activity, the overall network activity on a given trial and or in a given instance. And when we observe even the same things over and over again, the state of our system is just a little bit different. You know, it's what happened on the last time we saw this sort of thing is different than what is happening now. And those differences in really what the network state is on a trial by trial basis alter what happens as you view something. And as I said, it alters your behavior in the end. So I've been trying to figure out what drives this variability. There have been many competing models, I would say, competing ideas for how this could occur. And I have been trying to systematically sort of tease apart what the predictions of each one of those different models is. Try to see which of these potential models is actually correct. So I think one very prominent idea is the reason why neurons are so variable is that there's some very strong interaction that's happening between excitatory and inhibitory drive onto cells. The variability that we see in the spiking is just really due to some small temporal irregularities in the amount of excitatory and inhibitory tone.
This is sort of momentary imbalances.
Momentary imbalances, yeah. And the problem with that idea is I don't think there's any data that support that idea. And one of the reasons why I don't think that there's any data is it always imagines that these imbalances occur almost on the synaptic time course. They should be very rapid changes in the balance between excitation and inhibition. But actually, the time scale of the sort of fluctuations, the ongoing rumble that we see from intracellular recordings is not rapid. It's actually slow. There are big modulations in memory potential, and they don't really fluctuate at the time scale of synaptic drive.
Can I stop you for a second?
Sure.
Because when we talked about rumble before, I think we were talking about some sort of population measure or something, but now you're talking about rumble in intracellular recording, meaning that those are variations of membrane potential, right?
So, yeah, when I meant rumble before, I really meant the fact that if you're making an observation of the membrane potential, which it reflects the potential of this total synaptic drive onto the cell, we see these big sort of events that happen, and then there's sort of quiescence, and then there's another big event.
So there should be both things, both population events and also membrane potential changes that you...
Yeah, so, I mean, I imagine that those events are caused by changes in synaptic drive that are occurring. And nowadays, actually, we're able to measure both things even simultaneously. So you can measure large populations of neurons extracellularly while you're doing whole cell recording. It turns out that those are amazingly correlated. The correlation between just the overall population drive of random 200 neurons that you record from while simultaneously recording whole cell, it's like 0.8. It's an incredibly robust correlation between just the overall activity in the population without selecting which cells are connected to which. And a single neuron is incredibly high. So all that rumble or that ongoing activity that I think we see in our memory potential recordings simply reflects total network activation. Or it might be local to the column or nearby cells, but it's not that there's some fine interwoven network that is driving something. There's some sort of global changes that are just occurring.
So one question is, I always think about flipping the question. So you have the question, whoa, why are things so variable?
Yeah.
So how come we see the same thing every time? Like, we have the stimulus, right? It's not like you show the same stimulus and you're going to get it. Well, why are you showing me the same thing? It looks the same.
Yeah.
And we have to do all these processes. And if you do object recognition, it's not like you get it wrong a lot of times because... But your brain presumably on have a different trial. There's like big global patterns in the cortex that are different. So how come they don't make any difference? Or we can tell the difference between things that are important for processing or discrimination and these other differences.
So there are important differences and there are unimportant differences that exist. So I want to be able to recognize you as Todd, independent of what the lighting condition is, independent of successive times that we're actually seated. So I think that there's an overall strategy of trying to get rid of variables that don't matter to focus on variables that do matter. What the precise pattern of dots is, that doesn't really matter for us to make a decision about whether it's rightwards or leftwards. And so I think our systems actually try to eliminate that information. Now, the fact that if you observe the same dot pattern and you make different decisions, and we can link that to neural activity, I think that's important because it says actually, even though you don't have to keep track of what those individual dots were, you're getting a sense of what the internal state was that's actually making the decision and how that's actually linked to what the initial drive was. So I think this idea of saying, well, you know, there's this variability that exists and it should, you know, that that's not important because we don't actually care about what the actual dot patterns is. Well, yes, we don't ever care about what the dot pattern is. And in fact, in those experiments, the animal didn't care what the dot pattern was. The animal cared whether it was moving left or it was moving right. And that's the basis for the decision. So there's some, in some cases, in that case specifically, you want some invariance to the dot pattern. We're specifically trying to get rid of that sort of information, just like I want to specifically get rid of the information about the current lighting situation and how it might impact how I recognize you. Like it's just sort of irrelevant. So I think that's just a whole process that happens as you move information from the retina through our sensory systems, this idea that we're trying to get to a representation which is invariant to the condition.
So does that mean that, let's see, one way of thinking about the visual system is that it's a kind of series of processing steps. And so the visual cortex is the primary visual cortex pretty early in the visual processing steps. And so I might decide, well, the primary visual cortex is not caring about what the animal's task is. It's just trying to figure out what the visual stimulus is. And it'll give it to some other cortical area that goes, oh, well, in view of the task, we're only interested in this aspect of it. It sounds like you're saying the primary visual cortex reflects that whole process somehow.
I mean, I think the traditional view of primary visual cortex was that it's encoding the sensory environment. And maybe it's trying to make a representation that is invariant to the state of the animal. And it is just trying to provide visual information. And that downstream areas could sample that information in different ways. And it's been described as sort of something like a post office or set of mailboxes in which individual different kinds of information get slotted into different boxes, and then those get routed to different places. So, for example, the motion information might be routed along the dorsal pathway, or the ventral pathway might get information about objects and things like that. But the idea is that primary visual cortex was visual. It's a sensory area.
So is that right?
And it's not clear that that's right. And particularly given some changes that we've seen in over the last 10 years, I would say. But I would say that was right. And then what you see is that as you move through the visual system, that the influences of state systematically increase. So a great example of this is with attention. You see very mild changes in activity in V1 with attention, but if you go to somewhere like V2 or V4 or MT or LIP, these areas that are farther along in the visual hierarchy, then you get progressively more and more signatures of internal state and intention of what the animal intends to do.
So you might expect a lot of variability depending on other things that are happening to the animal.
Absolutely. You might expect more variability in those cells if we're only thinking of the stimulus as what the visual stimulus mm-hmm. is. And in fact, you do see a lot of variability all throughout. But one thing that is very clear is that the degree of variability is subject to state. So, for example, if an animal decides is is just in sort of what we call the spontaneous condition, where there's no instruction, the cells tend to respond in an incredibly variable fashion. And that's probably because there's ongoing things in their mind that are happening. But once you give them an instruction, like say, hey, you know, I want you to move your arm rightwards, then variability starts to decline. They're still variable, but they're not as variable as in this sort of unconstrained condition. You see this in vision as well. In the spontaneous condition, when there's no visual drive, cells tend to be very variable. We would call them superposition just because the statistics of their firing is whatever is greater than Poisson. Once you drive them with a stimulus, it declines towards one. This is just a common pattern that exists throughout the neocortex. And it depends upon what the specific function of that area is. So in orbital frontal cortex, you can see this with when they're about to get a reward or when they have to like make a decision about what the reward valence is of an object. Then you see a decline. It doesn't depend upon really the sensory stimulus in and of itself. Okay, so the traditional view, at any rate, of vision was that there was this sort of pure sensory representation. And that's a very nice view in V1. There's a pure sensory representation. And then these other systems go along and pick that out, pick out specific aspects of that, and integrate that with the internal state, goals that we have. And those things get mixed together. And I think this has dramatically changed over the last 10 years. And it's dramatically changed with, first of all, the increased use of awake animals in which we can really change the state of the animals. But I think even more, it has been the introduction of a new model system to study vision, which has been the rodent, the mouse. One of the things that happened when everybody switched to using mice, which was great because now we can use these wonderful tools. They actually have a very large visual cortex. So a significant portion of their neocortex is actually devoted to vision. It's larger than the auditory portion or the somatosensory portion. But it's hard to train animals to do the sort of things that we had done with the traditional species like primates. So we don't ask them to fixate or to look at a spot. They don't even have fovea in which they could do that. And so we had to like sort of relax what our control over the state of the animal. And then the other thing that happened is we started to let them, rodents like to run, they like to walk, they like to explore. And so we started to put them on balls to let them walk around while they're recording. When an animal is exploring versus when it's stationary, that's a dramatic state change that happens. And it has a massive impact on primary visual cortex. So the firing rate of neurons in primary visual cortex goes up by about 4 times when they start to walk. The state of the whole system gets shifted. And we now know that that happens also in the thalamic region, LGN, that provides input into the cortex. It happens all the way back in the retina. There's just a whole change in the gain of the system when the animal decides to move. I'm sure we'll figure out exactly which signaling cascade causes that, but there's a whole change in the nature of the system. And this sort of, in some sense, violates the kind of the initiating principle that primary visual cortex was going to be a sensory area that provided just sensory information. Now we know that it's not just providing sensory information. Those first clues were like running is a big modulator of visual cortical activity. But now we see all sorts of other things like which direction they're in. If they turn their head, you can get these cells that seem to be sensitive, at least you can decode the direction of the head from the population of V1 cells, even though the visual stimulus has been kept the same.
And if you don't keep track of the direction of the head, that just looks like random variability in
That's
your experiment.
Right. That's right. And we would have not changed the head location in those older experiments that we would have done. Everything would have been head fixed. And so it was something that we never really approached in the way that we've been able to approach it with rodent studies. Now, I'm not saying that head direction is encoded in V1, but there are signatures of head direction. There, you can find things that look kind of like place fields now in V1. It's just opened up, like, how do we think about what's happening in primary visual cortex? It's certainly no longer the case that we can think of this as a purely sensory region for vision. It's much more multimodal. And it's also there's been a whole series of questions now about whether this actually exists in primates or is this just a specialization in rodents. And it's not clear. It's hard to actually get primates to run around. It's hard to do this experiment, you know.
They'd rather sit there and fixate on that thing for hours and hours.
They just have a different mode.
Yeah, they want to do video games.
and they just have a different mode of working. And so it's not clear that we can make the same analogy, at least for running versus stationary. And then there are also contradictory reports about what the actual effects are. Maybe in the periphery there are large effects of the animal running versus in the central representation. At any rate, I think the exciting thing is that it's kind of changed the framework of how we study V1. And I think that's a really important change, because I feel like we had been kind of limited by the type of experiments that we were doing and the sort of standard framework for how we think about coding in V1. And the rodent has sort of allowed us to loosen those rules and explore a little bit more what could be there. Now, it's also kind of, has a downside, and that is we've sort of lost some of the guiding lights or the anchors that we had to guide our science.
So I have two questions. One is, like, so have we gone back to ask the questions, the old school questions, whether they're different running versus not running? Like, are the cells, is the orientation tuning change? Does discrimination, the ability for mice to discriminate, is that changing the way that V1 is, like, acting as a visual system? Do we know? It's a lot harder to do all those experiments now, right? Because there's a lot more going on.
Start to question everything. Is a simple cell still a simple cell when the mouse is...
Yeah, the receptor fields don't change that much. But definitely how they are. So if you measure, like, the spike triggered average, try and sort of make a measurement of the spatial receptive field, they still have a spatial receptive field.
That's good.
And so that still exists, but the way that they're transmitting that information is now different. It's a different code. And I can still decode everything, but I have to know whether the animal, what the state of the animal is, to do a proper decoding measurement. So I think that's the portion about it that's sort of like, if we want to do these sort of decoding exercises or understand what's happening, we have to know a little bit more about the state of the animal. And that's a little tricky in the mouse because we don't control that. We actually don't control that in the mouse. And whereas the traditional experiments, it was finely controlled. We have exquisite control over the behavior of the animal. We can make them repeat the same thing 2,500 times a day. They will do it for us. And that allowed us to really, really get to sort of the fine scale details of the responses. But with rodents, yeah, you just can't do that.
So from a coding point of view, for you, you have to know that to decode the neuron's activity, but for the next neuron in the chain, it also needs that information to decode the neuron's activity, you think?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. It depends upon how orthogonal the representations are, right? Like, if we imagine that, so let's just imagine something like running state is modulating the activity, right? Now, it could be doing it, like, if they still have the same receptor fields, maybe you can just average this out and it's not going to matter. That would be the case if the state of the animal, that representation was orthogonal to say the orientation selectivity of of the cell. So you could just pretend to, you could just ignore it, and it would all average out. The problem is there are some dependencies that exist, and then so that's where you have to actually keep track of those two different things. But you should be able to orthogonalize those, and I actually think that is part of this whole process of making things invariant. That is the process of moving through information through the cortex, of trying to say, hey, I want to encode something invariant to whether I'm running or I'm not running, or the lighting condition that we're in, all of those things. The goal is to try to put that sensory information into a space in which appropriate behaviors can be engaged, right? It's not to encode the sensory information correctly. It's to figure out what the representation is so that you can make the right behavioral decision. That's it. And so that may mean that you want to react to things differently in running versus not running. That may mean that, and that's a dependency that we would want. But it may mean, but for other things, we might not want those things to interact. And that, in that respect, you want to orthogonalize those two representations.
But so that still said, like a true sensory this stuff, right? You still want to make the sensory represent invariants that are be useful for behavior later. But so what if, and this is what I've been thinking about for multiple cortical areas, right? What if one of the things the cortex is doing is making the invariants depending on the behavior, right? So you learn to do something. Now in primary visual cortex, maybe it's pretty stable and you want to do the same kind of invariance for lots and lots of behaviors, so it's not really a big issue. But primary visual cortex is weird, and so this general processor of the cortex and the circuit is, maybe it's weird and it does this weird thing. But in lots of things, one of the things is you want to make the invariance in the task that you learn. You learn something, we make a lot of our rodents do tasks. And they have to learn what the invariants that are important that they have to know for the behavior. So where is that interface between like the behavior and the cortical sensory activity? And you want to be able to modify the invariants, ignore some things, pay attention to other differences, and then still have that stable. So that's this thing I can't, I don't know how you do that and how you study it. Because I think to study it, you need to design some task where you're making the animal change the invariants in a way that you can assess and measure, you know, some things that you think about context or the task or something, and understand them of how they change the invariances of things that you think about orientation tuning or sensory receptive fields or something like that.
I mean, there are some examples of people doing this. One way is to, particularly in reward. So you can provide animals with an option of make associations between what, like a visual stimulus and what the sort of reward is that they're going to get. So people can learn that, and animals learn this as well. So if you give them 3 drops of juice for the green plus, and 4 drops of juice for, you know, the star or something like that, you can find cells in orbital frontal cortex that will actually record, that will actually represent the reward valence of those objects, independent of what those precise objects actually are. So I think that's an example of an invariance that's directly related to behavior, because what you're trying to do is you're just trying to figure out how much reward am I going to get for this thing, and you don't actually care what that thing is. Who cares about the green star or the green plus and the star?
But some part of the brain must have said that's a green star, because otherwise you wouldn't know what the reward is.
But that's what I would say is that's the whole process of our sensory systems trying to convert these things into a reasonable representation, which tells you something reasonable, like how much am I going to get for this thing?
Yeah.
Right? That's what you want to know, because that informs your decision. Right, and whether it's green plus or whatever, that doesn't matter at all. Of course, there were cells in V1 that had to encode that, right? But that's uninteresting, and you want to get rid of it. So,
but the thing is that you make the sensory and those things, which is reasonable, you're studying the behavior and the reward contingencies. You make the sensory thing simple, the distinguish between a Greensville and a plus,
yeah.
And you're never going to get confused at that level. And you're just remapping those things that are states. So what I'm imagining is that you want to have the discrimination and the sensory thing interact with the reward contingencies so that the thing that you have to pay attention to discriminate whether this is a good or a thing or not, is something that's hard enough that your sensory system has to work. And then it has to change.
I see. Yeah.
And then, but that makes it really hard, right, to get it to do that. But that seems like the thing about the flexibility, because we recognize objects and we can, someone, at least us, will do something different with those objects, right? And when the rules change, and it's no problem, you still recognize the objects and you still change them all. But you're discriminating different aspects of the objects and you're doing different things with them. And it's pretty fast.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two aspects here. There's one is like the visual representation, which is really simple. Usually in these cases, it's really simple. And it's simple by design because they don't want to worry about what the visual representation is. And then, and then what the reassociation is to reward in this case, right? and so you can, of course, put uncertainty on either of those two different aspects. We could make more uncertainty about what that visual stimulus actually is, or we could make more uncertainty about how that visual stimulus is related to reward. And I think both of those questions are really interesting. They get at different aspects of this whole idea of trying to either segregate things or separate different classes of objects into some sort of reward. But I think you can do both of both of those strategies, I think, are reasonable. I think they're different.
So, but I was sort of hearing it as subtext of Todd, and maybe he didn't mean it at all.
Sure.
That whether the green triangle is good or not is going to feed back to the visual cortex and affect the visual cortex's representation of that, because the things that are good are things I really want to see. And the things that have no importance, I might not work, my brain might not want to work that hard.
So there's where I think like things have really changed in vision, right? Because it used to be very hard for us to show, for example, that there were attentional effects or any processing change in V1 due to what the expected reward is. And they are clear as day in mouse V1. They absolutely are there. They're a big signal. If you get rewarded more for the green triangle, cells in V1 are going to start to respond more. That's totally true. Is that a quirk of the rodent? I'm not sure. Or is it that we have sort of broadened our perspective about how we actually do these experiments? They're challenging in the rodent. And maybe we didn't quite do them correctly when we did them in the primate. And I think both of those things are possible. So it might be the case that there are some specializations in the rodent that account for maybe the reduced amount of space they have. They don't have a whole lot of maybe frontal areas to be able to deal with maybe processing reward signals or something like that, or figuring out what is rewarding. So maybe some of that has been sort of brought back. This is this sort of thing that's called the encephalization hypothesis.
Could you just say what that hypothesis is?
Well, it's the idea that it's a very vague idea, and it's not one that I should say I support. But the idea is that as we get more cortex, that we've changed the jobs that each one of our areas are doing. So that we have more, we can have a pure sensory, maybe a pure sensory representation. And then later on, we can push things to be later on. And so I think a good example of this is in vision. So maybe there isn't as much visual circuitry in the mouse. And so at the very first stages, you might want to do some processing. For example, you might want to compute direction selectivity. You might want to compute orientation selectivity. You should do those. There's no reason to wait until a visual cortex to do that. You should do that right where you can in the retina. And indeed, you find all these orientation selective and direction selective neurons right there in the retina. They've recently been found in the primate, but this is a very, very, very small number of cells. They exist. It's not like they're gone in the primate. But we've completely devoted our vision, most of our vision, to two different cell classes. They're called MMP cells. It doesn't really matter. But we've really reduced that representation to being very simple. And the idea is you encephalize the rest of the computation into later stages.
So right,
where you don't have where you don't have the constraint of space. If you want to do an analysis of orientation and direction out in the retina because you don't have enough space in the cortex, then you have to deal with the physics of the retina, right? Because you have to have a representation for all different directions and everything like that. In our retina, we've decided, no, we just want to make a code that will fit into our retina because we have a packing problem, potentially, and we can do those analyses later on. So the idea is you sort of encephalize the processes to be later because you have more space up in the cerebral cortex.
So it kind of means the circuits get dumber and as we have more sophisticated brain.
That's right.
The frog's eye tells the frog's brain about bugs.
That's right.
And their direction of flight. But our eye doesn't tell our brain that. It doesn't. It's completely impartial. I don't see any bugs. All I see are patterns of light.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's one idea is that basically this stuff just gets, in the rodent, it just gets pushed back to visual cortex, maybe because there aren't frontal areas to support it. And so everything gets brought back sort of earlier than you might expect. So I call that encephalization. Yeah.
So do you think that's, well, of course, we don't know whether that's really right because we can't compare, it's apples and oranges, the data we have on our visual cortex versus the mice. It's just incomparable data because we can't do the same.
We can't do it, but I think that in a sense, there's a couple other things about the organization of the functional organization in mouse visual cortex is very different than the functional organization in carnivores or in primates. We don't know why that is.
In what way?
In carnivores and in sort of like cats or ferrets or in primates like the macaque or marmoset, there's this beautiful map of orientation selectivity across the surface of the cortex, such that neurons that have similar selectivities are right next to each other. And it forms this beautiful mapping that exists, and that is entirely absent in the rodent. It just doesn't exist. So you can find cells right next to each other that are selective for completely different things, completely different orientations. They're still orientation selective, but there is no map that exists. We actually know this is not related to the size of the animal. And the reason is that people have done recordings in the capybara, which is a very large rodent.
Unusual size.
And they express this same pattern.
How about squirrels?
And squirrels also, which are diurnal animals, great visual system. They do color. They also have no orientation. We call this thing orientation column. So they don't have any functional organization as well. Whereas even a very small primate, smaller than a squirrel, they will have a nice functional organization. There are sort of large-scale differences between just the whole organization that exists in the rodent, which tells you that maybe something different is this area is being utilized maybe for some other function than in the primate. Now, that doesn't mean it's better worse, but actually what it points to is maybe there's multiple solutions to the problem that the animal faces, and maybe the animals are facing different problems. I actually don't think that's correct, because the squirrel is a great example. Squirrels have behavior like many primates, you know, and yet they don't have this organization. So I don't actually think there's a different behavioral load. I'm not sure what the difference is, but it seems like rabbits and rodents, which are all part of the same sort of portion of our tree, our mammalian tree, just have lost that. And I would love to know why.
But that's one thing I would say is takeaway is fine spatial organization of function may not be absolutely necessary. Right? Because obviously the mouse can see okay without it. And then birds don't even have layers.
Yeah, well, that's a different...
But they do fine. So there must be lots of different solutions.
Absolutely. There's lots of different solutions. And it's not the case that... it's called the neocortex because it's a new region of the brain. It's just for mammals, right? And so it's not like this is some evolutionarily conserved thing that is ancient. This is new. This is just us. And it's not it's sort of not surprising to me that different animals use it for different things. And I think that's a great thing. It's a great thing to see that the problems can be solved in different ways.
It'd be interesting to know. I mean, what's the advantage of having cells with the same orientation close to each other instead of having them, like in place cells in the hippocampus, are not spatially laid out at all. They're just willy-nilly in the hippocampus. Two place cells that are for the same space, maybe really long way away, and people go, I ask you, doesn't that bother you? And they go, no. As long as they're wired the same way with each other, then what difference does it make where they are?
Yeah, I mean, I think the best argument that's been made for this functional organization is a wire length minimization sort of idea, where you're trying to make your connections between cells be as near as possible. And then you get, if you make that sort of assumption, there's a beautiful set of papers that have really tried to play with that assumption and see what emerges if you force things to be you reward networks that have shorter distances, and you do get the emergence of these.
So that would suggest brain size is important. Like if your brain's small enough, you don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, but then the capybara.
Well, it depends more on density, I guess, of the brain. It's still good to optimize, do the best you can. If you use it at all, it doesn't matter necessarily. I mean, I guess the penalty you pay for having a big brain and stuff like might be different.
Yeah.
Well, thanks a lot, Nicholas. It's been great to have you back. I hope it won't be 11 years before we see you again.
Oh, thanks. It was fun to be here. Yeah.
Thanks, and Todd, thanks for joining us.
Sure, it's been fun.
This has been our Scientist Talk Shop.